there's really no way to sum up in a 45-minute class all the things about Jesus. We did, if you were in last week's class, talk about from lesson 10 some of the introductory things about Jesus, especially the early years. This study, as you look at the top, his ministry, and there's just, you could just spend years literally on the ministry of Christ. So this lesson, like some others, is designed to provide kind of a brief overview, and then we'll try to, at the end, tie together some additional things. He begins, and it's a really good summary as far as the first paragraph. He says, the personal teaching ministry of Christ lasted about 3.5 years. During this time, he traveled all over Palestine, and if you've gone through the lesson already, you've probably looked at the little map down there on the right. He does list several key places, and it's a useful map for this lesson. He traveled over Palestine, performing miracles and teaching a new way of life. Well, that's really what he did. One of the best examples of that is found in the Sermon on the Mount. You have all those teachings that you've heard it said, but I say unto you, and so forth. So Jesus really did open up a new and living way, as the Hebrew writer mentions. At the end of this period, he was arrested and crucified at Calvary, surrendering his life that the world might be redeemed. If someone comes along and ever says to you, who's Jesus Christ? What do you believe about Jesus Christ? Here's a 30-second answer. This is who he was. This is what he intended to do and what he did accomplish. He mentioned in the previous lesson we left Jesus at Capernaum. Now, in Matthew chapter 9, verse 1, the Bible says his own city, speaking of Capernaum. The Lord decided to make Capernaum his own city, his headquarters, if you will. It's believed that if people lived in a place for a year, they could refer to that as their own city, and that is very possibly what happened with Jesus. We do a similar thing today. We have a residency requirement in some places, don't we? Have to be a resident for a certain period of time, maybe a few months, and then you can do some things that residents of that state do. The first century world operated in a similar way. So the Lord, based out of Capernaum for much of his ministry, and then he soon left Galilee. That would be that upper section of your map on the right for Judea. That, of course, would be in the lower, the bottom section on the map to attend the feast of Passover at Jerusalem. The Lord was good. He was obedient to God's law as far as the Old Testament, the feast that had been set up, and we see that obedience throughout his life. Then, while he was there in the area of Judea / Jerusalem, he cast out the money changers out of the temple and had the discussion with Nicodemus about the new birth. So when you come to that information in John chapter 3, I think Jesus has come from the north, he's gone down south, and this is the place where he had that talk about the new birth. Then he returns to Galilee through the area of Samaria, and what happens on that? The Bible says he must needs pass through Samaria. Well, you can kind of see that, Judea, Galilee, the straight shot was to just go up, go north, and you were going to pass through Samaria. But didn't he have a different need there? It wasn't so much a geographical need. What was it? It was a... Sure. It was a spiritual need. There was a lady that needed some information about what the Lord had to say, that living water, and he was willing to give that to her. So they had a very, very interesting conversation. Part of that conversation involved John 4, verse 24, gave this woman something to think about, some of the people in her community to think about as well. God is spirit. They that worship him must worship. That's absolutely required. They must worship him in spirit as well as truth. Then, as we think about the Galilean ministry of Jesus, the next big paragraph, he does end up back in Galilee. He remains there for about 2 years, and he's teaching, he's healing the sick. When a lot of people think about Jesus, they look at him as a great helper to mankind. He was someone who taught. He was someone who helped people. He was someone who gave great advice, or he offered great instruction. But that really wasn't why he came, was it? Why did he show up? Not just to, be like Socrates and Plato and give the world some interesting stuff to think about, and not just to make people feel better because everybody eventually dies. Why'd he come? For the Son of Man came to seek and to save that which is lost. So everything that you see about Jesus out here that we're talking about ultimately was designed to funnel down to that point. You guys are in trouble. I'm here to help you. So far, as we are told, he returned to Jerusalem only once during this period, once again, to observe God's law that was attending the Passover feast. He did visit Phoenicia. Where's Phoenicia on our map? Anybody find it? Okay, way up at the top and on the left, if you see Mediterranean Sea, right by the word sea, you'll see Phoenicia. So that's kind of interesting. That would be considered outside Palestine. So when you look at Jesus' ministry, for the most part, he's always staying within Palestine. You do have him and his family heading to Egypt, and then you do have this incident in Phoenicia. But unless we have some information that's not recorded, he stayed really confined within the land of Israel. And we should, at the end of class, offer an explanation for why that was. Once you begin to see some things that I'll present that are not in the lesson, you'll begin to think, wow, he had plenty to do. Then we have that next paragraph. Early in his Galilean ministry, Jesus returned to Nazareth, his boyhood home. This is also something that we'll return to at the end of this material. And you would think, if you go back home, how are you going to be received?
You would expect that.
To be received well or not well?
You would expect to be received well.
Yes. You know, you've headed off to the military, you've gone to college, you've picked up a job in another community, you've traveled for a little while, and you come back home, you're expecting to see mom and dad and the neighbors and, you know, reunite with some people and have a good, positive experience. But that's not what happened with Jesus. He comes back home and he's not received very well at all in what is referred to as his boyhood home. So Jesus is basically cast out and things continue to move forward. The Bible goes on to say that in those following months, there in the hills of Galilee, there were people who started coming to him. Some came literally for miles so that they could hear him teach and receive some kind of healing. And the Bible talks about people coming from all kinds of places, people having all kinds of various medical issues. And then you have, as things continue to unfold, he says on one of these trips to a mountain near Capernaum, Jesus preached the Sermon on the Mount. Where's Capernaum on our map?
North Central.
All right. That's a pretty good description for it. If you see Samaria, you can go up just about half an inch or so and you see Capernaum right there. So when you think about where was the Sermon on the Mount presented, that will give you an approximate location for it. Sermon on the Mount, at least Matthew's account of it, Matthew 5, 6, and 7. We also have some information from it scattered throughout the book of Luke and so forth. You've got that recorded to a great length. Out of 28 chapters, 3 chapters contain the Sermon on the Mount. And most have concluded, and I think this is correct, that this is likely the most famous sermon ever delivered. And then you've got Jesus also feeding some people. In addition to the great teaching, he mentions the 5,000. You've got the miracle, 5 loaves of bread, 2 small fish, and Jesus feeds all the people. Then you have another food miracle, if you will. You've got 4,000 men, and a similar thing happens with them. There would be some people that would show up for the free meal, just as people would today. But you also have, at least initially, I think a lot of the people that have come out to hear the teaching, and they want to receive some instruction from Jesus, and they really want to see what this guy can do. They want to see what he can say. This might be a really bad comparison for a couple of reasons, but suppose that there were a master magician like Houdini today, and they would say, come see Houdini. We're going to throw in a free meal. Why would you go? Is it primarily for the food, or is it primarily to see Houdini?
Depends on who you are, really.
Okay, I'm thinking of the common player, the commoner.
Probably.
I think most people would say the free meal is going to be nice, especially if it's good food. But, you know, if you're serving in mass, it's not going to be a 5-star restaurant meal. Most people would probably, I think, raise right. Most people would come and say, the food's nice, we appreciate that, especially if hadn't eaten in a little while, but we're coming to see the show. And it wasn't that Jesus was a show, but he was new, doing some amazing things, saying some things that these people had never heard, teaching in ways that was unlike anybody else. So it was just natural to come out and see him. And you have to, I think, kind of take our culture out of it as well. You know, we've got YouTube videos and all kinds of stuff. There may be some places that we can never go for whatever reason. But you can pull up Google Maps and actually see different parts of the world. You want to see this sea, or you want to see this mountain, or you want to see this desert, just pull up Google. And they will let you get some really good images. You know, you might be able to see some things that would really, really be impossible for you to see, regardless of you know, who you knew, or regardless of how much you're willing to pay. And we've got all kinds of other things that compete for our time. But in this day and time, you know, your life, you're grinding down there at the mill every day, you know, you're doing the work around the house and so forth. And anybody old enough to remember when the circus came to town? Okay, couple. And, you know, wasn't that the big thing? I mean, that was something that you look forward to, and it was just going to be a break from the everyday routine, because life was, you know, pretty consistent. But in our day and time, we've got a lot of other things to kind of break things up. There's always something divine calling for our time, but it wasn't quite like that in the first century. So Jesus comes to town, and we need to go see him and find out what's going on.
You know, in our lifetime, we've seen of the churches where they have faith healers coming and things. A lot of people will go and see that just to see what the guy's doing. Not necessarily because they believe him to begin with, but they want to see how he's doing to figure his trickery or something. So
yeah,
it's very similar to
the it is. You have something going on that is garnering the attention of a lot of people, especially if it seems to be in the magical, the miraculous area. And you find the same kind of thing. If you, the lady's going to swallow the sword, or you know, people are curious about that. So Jesus did arouse a lot of curiosity, not only by the teachings but by the miracles as well. You're exactly right. Okay, that final sentence on this page. He says, "So great did his popularity become that when one time he crossed the Sea of Galilee to escape the multitudes, they walked around the lake and found him on the other side." Now you imagine that. People are so interested in Jesus, they basically chase him. Jesus had that experience. The Lord did not confine his associations to the respectable. Now there again is something that stands out about the Lord. When you think about people today, oftentimes they want to cater, they want to cotton, if you will, to a certain class of people. But the Lord didn't do that. He was with the average people. He did have some interaction with some people that were not average. And then he had some interaction with some people who were not considered to be the respectable people in his day and time. We have at least one record of him eating a meal with some publicans, the people who were the tax collectors, the despised people of that day and time. And he received a lot of criticism. But what did he respond with? Going to go out there and eat with sinners? What did he say? Came not to call the righteous, but the sinners, the people who need it. Well, when he said, "I didn't come to call the sinners," how would you understand that? I thought he did come to it. I mean, we cited Luke 19:10 earlier. "For the Son of Man came to seek and save that which was lost," where there's some people that were just so righteous, God said through the Lord, "I don't need you. Don't need to talk to you." What do you mean, "I didn't come to call the righteous"? There's probably a word missing there. What kind of righteous? Yes, the self-righteous person, the person who kind of thought, "Well, I'm good with God, I don't need anything." The Lord said, "I'm not here to deal with you. I would help you if you would humble yourself and recognize that you need me, but if you're going to, in your spiritual life, think that you've got everything figured out and you're fine," he said, "well, you know, we're probably not going to have too much association." But when you look at the people who were regarded as the sinners, even in our day and time, do you think that the person that is involved with bad things knows that he or she is a sinner?
No. But they know it, that they think
you're all fine. Well, yeah, you do have that as well. But generally, they will go ahead and recognize the shortcomings. If you've got somebody sitting in the jail cell, prison cell, assuming that they're guilty, and I think generally that's going to be the case, you know, they know that they've done wrong. And if you're dealing with somebody out there that is on the street, they know that their way of life is not what it should be. And if you talk to people, and I have, they would say, "Well, I know that my life is not right. I know that I have a lot of shortcomings. My sins are great." Can you work with that kind of person? You can. But when you have somebody who is filled with pride, they think that they've got everything figured out, they never make a mistake, they're just error-free in every way, there's not much that you can do with that kind of individual. Then he says, in bold, special attention should be made of his taking care, or was taking rather, three of his closest disciples with him to the mountaintop to pray. They were there. Jesus was transfigured in the most glorious way. Moses, Elijah, they both appear, they're talking with the Lord. Peter, of course, makes that unwise suggestion. He was going to build a tabernacle for the three of them. And then there's the voice coming from heaven. The other fellows disappear. And what's the voice say? "This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased." The implied message in that seems to be what? Moses,
but not as good as.
Yeah, he was okay for a time, but now, who's on deck? Jesus is, and he's going to set up a new system that you're going to follow, and Moses, the other Old Testament characters that you're familiar with, they're going to fade into the past because that Old Testament system is about to be replaced. So, as he rightly concludes, we're not subject to Moses nor the law that he gave, but to the sovereignty of Christ. The Lord is absolute. Then we have Jesus' ministry in Judea and in Perea. Now, if you go back to the map, you can find these two places very easily. You're going to find Judea down there on the bottom, and then you'll also be able to see Perea over there on the right. Perea is a pretty good section. Perea is not mentioned in the Bible per se, but I mean it is an area, and that did have some association with Jesus and his ministry. He says, after 2 years of teaching in Galilee, Jesus returned to Jerusalem for the Feast of Tabernacles. There were multiple festivals for the Jewish people. Even before this, the Pharisees, the leading religious and political sect among the Jews, had started to oppose him. Their lawyers had attempted to ensnare him with words, but they had always failed. I think that's a significant point. If you have a bright lawyer, and you're put on the stand, and you're being quizzed by that lawyer, and this lawyer has had time to think about how to trap you, how to entice you, what to say to get you to trip yourself up as far as your testimony, or what to say that's going to make you look bad, or accomplish something that his witness, that his client needs, you think that lawyer is going to be able to outfox you?
He's hoping so.
Okay. Well, and our association with the court system is probably not going to be that great. We might not see where that guy is going, and we might well fall for that particular trap. And what if we have a situation where it's not just one lawyer that's after us? What if we've got a whole team of lawyers? 20, 30, 50 people. You think they're going to beat us?
The odds are not stacked in our favor.
No, they are definitely not stacked in our favor. Well, that was what Jesus was going up against. There were people who were trained in God's law. They were trained in things like debate. They knew how to argue, and they were very, very good at what they did. Now, here you have Jesus, the homeboy, Nazareth, in contact with some of these lawyers. How would you expect that he's going to fare with them? You'd think that they're just going to wipe him off the map. And that's surely what they thought. I mean, where'd you get your religious degree? Where'd you get your law degree? I don't have one. I come from a carpentry background. Yeah, we'll fix you. You know, we could send out the JV league and take care of you. Well, they end up with the varsity folks. And it did not go very well for them. Okay, so back to the Pharisees, this political sect among the Jews, very influential. They began to oppose him. The lawyers had attempted to ensnare him with words. Every single time, they failed. And they came along, and you have, between the Sadducees and the lawyers, you do find that sometimes it was going, we're going to hit you from this side, and then we're going to have some people hit you from this side. Multiple attacks, different attacks. You think, for example, about Matthew chapter 22. They talk about the Levirate law and the brother. Fellow who had been married to multiple women, seven wives, and then the question, whose wife is she going to, or whose, which woman is going to be associated with this man in the resurrection? I would not have wanted to have faced that question. And surely these fellows thought that that question was going to be one that Jesus could not answer. And they were, be able to point out that he was trying to dodge the matter, and the Lord comes right out and gives them an answer that, sends them packing. They're just not able to deal with it. Well, if you can't get this guy off your back, if you can't ask questions that are going to potentially disrupt him, and he's really causing some serious issues for you, people might get mad enough to the point where they're going to do what? All right, we've got to kill him. You know, let's contract it out. Let's do whatever it takes to kill this guy. Well, is that what happened with the Lord? It didn't take very long. And you can see now, I think, why Jesus spent so much time up there in the north, so that he would be able to teach and influence. He spent some time there down in Jerusalem as well. And surely God could have protected him had he spent all 3 years down there, but it would have made his life very, very difficult, a lot more difficult than it was, had he been down there in the south, where you had these shrewd political and legal people that were always trying to trip him up. So you get just a hint at some of the things that he must have experienced. All right, now after talking about the fact that they wanted to kill him, they decided that his popularity was too great for such an attempt. Think about, for example, Phil Robertson, Duck Dynasty. You have kind of the same thing there in principle. Someone is very, very popular, and for some reason, another person, another group is upset at that individual and wants to destroy him. And yet, even though there's that desire, they don't do it for what reason? We can't take him off the show, or we can't permanently remove him because the viewers are going to kill us. We just can't do that. So popularity sometimes will cause a person to hang around or stay around. Maybe not for as long as a person might like, but still it can affect the way that people make decisions, and in this case it certainly did. The Lord was able to leave Jerusalem in peace. He journeyed across the Jordan River into Perea, which we pointed out on the map. It was here in Judea that Jesus spent his last months before the arrest and the crucifixion. And then he says, as he traveled back and forth across the two provinces, he prepared his disciples for the day he would no longer be with them as their shepherd. That's what we've been talking about in John. John 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, the Lord's Supper, Matthew chapter 26. You have a lot of Jesus' life summed up in those chapters, and a great deal of attention is paid to his final days. All right, under this next heading, the apostles in blue, Jesus had many disciples. Anyone who truly follows him is his disciple. The Lord knew that after he had gone, others would have to carry on his work. And that's right. Not even Jesus lives forever on the earth. His time here was limited, so he created apostles to come along and help continue things. And our job is to try to prepare people, to help motivate Christians and help strengthen them in the Word so that they can carry on after we live. And that would include our kids and grandkids. Thus, he appointed 12 disciples as apostles to continue on with his work. An apostle, he says, is one that's sent forth with a commission. You do find the word apostle being used in two ways in the Bible. Apostolos, apostle, sometimes the basic meaning is one sent. Well, the 12, of course, were sent, but you also find some people who were not from the apostles in the sense that Jesus personally appointed them. You do find some regular people who were quote-unquote sent. So the word apostle doesn't always apply to the special men selected by Jesus, but it's, I think, generally safe to say that that's typical. That's typically the way that we find the word used. In another lesson, we'll study the commission which Jesus gave to the apostles. And then, as you look at the apostles, you do find some brothers, Peter and Andrew, and you've got the sons of Zebedee, James and John. You've got some people who were members of the inner circle, Peter, James, John. They went with him on some ventures that the others didn't go on. Then you've got some other people, Matthew, a former tax collector. He writes the book of Matthew. You've got Philip, Bartholomew, Thomas. And he, of course, is sometimes referred to Doubting Thomas, but that may not be the best description for him. He wanted the evidence that the others had seen. James, the son of Alphaeus, Thaddeus, or Judas, as he's sometimes called. Simon the Zealot, Canaanian, is what you find in some other translations. And then, of course, you have Judas Iscariot, always listed last. We don't know all of the backgrounds of the apostles, but we do know that about a third of them were from a fishing background. And Jesus had them with him for a few years. The training, he says, included the witnessing of the deeds performed by Jesus, listening to his teaching, and then they got some on-the-job training. They were also sent out, and Jesus let them preach, heal the sick, and they gained some valuable experience. Then, thinking about the miracles of Jesus, he says no study of Jesus' life would be complete without paying some attention, giving special notice to some of his miracles. His fame rested not only on his teaching, but also on the works, which demonstrated his deity. You do have, as you begin to break down the miracles, and this is not even a fraction of what he did, but 35 recorded miracles are mentioned when it comes to the life of Christ. Others are certainly alluded to. You do have 17 bodily cures. Well, even if this were just one problem that he cured 17 times, that would be pretty amazing. But that's not what we find. He cured multiple issues. And then you have several blind men being healed, sights restored. You have problems like paralysis being successfully dealt with and immediately dealt with. You have the deaf and the blind. You have the deaf and the dumb. They're able to hear. They're able to speak again. You do have people being raised from the dead. At least you've got three examples of that. You've got the widow's son at Nain. You've got Jairus' daughter. He, of course, was synagogue ruler. And then you've got Lazarus. He was also raised from the dead. You've got miracles that involve nature, stilling the storms and so forth. You've got the feeding of people, literally thousands of people. Jesus manufactures bread, manufactures fish, if you will. And then at the top of the next page, before you look at the box, what happened to the 12, you have here a point which I was alluding to earlier. Jesus did not simply do miracles to impress people. It was not something like a magical show where people come and say, well, see what he can conjure up today. But it was for a purpose. You may remember from Mark's account, from Mark 16, verses 15 through 20, that Jesus said, I want you to go. I want you to teach the gospel. I want you to present the gospel to each creature. He said, signs are going to follow you. Talking about, drinking poison, if that happened, if you were bitten by a snake, it wouldn't hurt you and so forth, speaking with new tongues, casting out demons, all of those things. And the Bible says they went forth, they preached everywhere, the Lord working with them. And then, do you remember that next key word? And confirming the word by the signs that followed. Well, that's a helpful verse. It's not the only passage. But it is a text which tells us why those signs were done. They were designed to confirm the word. If somebody shows up today and says, I'm from God, well, what's probably going to be the first question that goes through a mind or should go through a mind? Yeah. You know, how do I know? What evidence do you have? You know, show me a sign. Well, there were times where Jesus was asked to show a sign, but he'd already shown signs. He'd shown plenty of signs. And you see sometimes, I think, going back to the magician, if you have a magic trick, and I try to keep a few, they're not great, but sometimes for small kids, I'll pull out a magic trick. If you have a magic trick and you perform that for the child, what might the child say? Well, okay, that's going to be one of the things that you're probably going to hear. And after you hear that question, there's probably going to be a follow-up. Bonnie, you may have given the answer.
I said, how'd you do that?
Oh, okay, well, you both had the same answer then. What might the second question be?
I want to see.
Yeah, will you do it again? Mm-hmm. I want to see it a second time. And people are interesting. Even adults. Do you suspect that you find that same kind of thing with Jesus? I mean, for example, he puts on a guy's ear, Malchus's ear. You're there, you witness it. There's no, I mean, you maybe you held the ear, maybe you saw it fall on the floor, those kinds of things. And yet after Jesus restores it, sometimes people can say in their mind, I need to see it again. Well, how many times do you need to see it? How many times do you need to see somebody still the storm? How many times do you need to see him walk on the water? How many times do you need to see him manufacture bread for people? How many times do you need to see a dead person raised? But there's a quirk. And you know, when you think back to some Bible stories, Gideon, for example, there were a couple times, you know, where you find some things repeated. God says, okay, you know, I'll give you a couple or maybe multiple. But you do find at the same time some hard hearts where a person sees it and sees it and sees it and they're never really convinced. And that's a problem. But God has given us plenty of testimony, plenty of evidence, plenty of miracles through Jesus to believe that he actually was able to do these things and he truly was from God. Finishing out that paragraph, he says, he performed them that men would believe his teachings and realize his deity. Well, that's right. You remember Thomas? I believe it's in John chapter 20. The Lord appears and he says, my Lord and my God. You know, and that is to be the reaction that we should have. We've been given enough information to believe that Jesus is who he claimed to be. Okay, when he healed an individual, the healing was instantaneous. Now, some people say, well, what about that event where the Lord partially healed the man's eyes? The fellow said, I see people, you know, walking as trees. Well, still there. Wasn't the healing instantaneous? Jesus didn't say you got to wait a week, a month, a year. You know, there it was done in two stages, but still those stages were banged. And bang. So I still don't see why people would point to that and say the healing wasn't instantaneous. We've certainly got it, I think, taking place in less than a minute, maybe 30 seconds. It did not take a period of days, as is true with some who claim to heal miraculously today. And that was what I think Ray was alluding to earlier with some of the faith healers. People see that and, oh yeah, you know, she can walk for a little while. But then she goes back to the medicine or goes back to the crutches or the walker. Likewise, he healed many of whom? He required no faith. Lazarus, obviously, he's dead. So there was no way for him to have any faith. When he curses the fig tree, the fig tree didn't have any faith. So that is also a claim by faith healers today sometimes. Well, you're not healed, you're not cured because you don't have faith. Well, if it's the power of God compared to, I use me as an example, compared to my lack of faith, what's greater? If I don't have faith in the resurrection, I don't have faith in God. I don't have faith in the resurrection. I don't have faith in Jesus. I just say all of that religious stuff is hooey. Is that going to stop me from being raised at the end of time? No. Okay, he says, modern faith healers who say that they cannot heal without faith in the part of the subject, they simply do not follow the example of Jesus. You have in Acts chapter, I believe, is it 19? Paul, Elimaeus, a sorcerer, was able to curse the fella, and he wasn't able to see for a season, so there certainly was no faith there in Paul's ability to do that. All right, some questions that people ask sometimes, one of which involves the 12. We really don't have much information about the 12 apostles as far as what happened to them. Now, that's kind of odd because there have been some people who have written some books on what happened to the 12 apostles. So information is not in the Bible, but some people have written actually some fairly thick books, maybe 150, 175 pages. They've tried to draw from secular history. Maybe some of it's true, maybe most of it's true, maybe none of it's true. But there's just a little information that we have about these men in the Bible. He says, you've got them there on the day of Pentecost when the church was established. They continue to stay in Jerusalem after the first major persecution scatters most of the brethren, Acts 8, verse 1. Then you've got some information about Peter's early activities in Palestine and also of those of John when in the company of Peter. Judas, of course, we know about him. He took his own life. And then you've got James. Acts 12, 2 tells us that he was put to death by Herod. We think that would have been about A.D. 44. Eusebius, an historian, relates a tradition that the apostles, they drew lots for mission fields. You'll find that information in a lot of different places. Again, that may or may not be correct. And then that they went throughout the earth preaching the world, preaching the gospel. All except John are thought to have died as martyrs. John spent a number of years at Ephesus. We know from Revelation that he was banished there, the island of Patmos, from our study in Revelation, and then apparently died a natural death at the end of the first century. Anything that you want to add or ask over what we've talked about? Okay, let's go over our questions and see what we've got there. Personal ministry of Jesus lasted for 7 years. False. Would have lasted for about how long? Okay, about half that time, 3.5 years. While in Jerusalem for the Passover, Jesus cast the money changers out of the temple. Yes, so there was some activity by him in the temple, beginning of his ministry and also the end. The ministry of Jesus in Galilee lasted about 2 years. True, remember that was going to be a little safer up there. When he visited his own people in Nazareth, they had a big party for him. False, there was no celebration. They tried to cast him off a hill and kill him. Jesus once fed 5,000 men with 25 loaves and 3 fishes. False. Some followed him because they hoped to get a free meal. Yeah. And again, that may not have been everybody. We think the majority probably really wanted to see him, but there were some people that were seeking the bread. Jesus was afraid to eat with sinners like the publicans. That's false. The last teaching of Jesus before his crucifixion was done in Perea and Judea. Okay. Then let's fill in the numbers. He was the brother of Andrew.
Peter,
number one. And he doubted Jesus had come back from the grave. Thomas, number five. He was a former tax collector, Matthew, number 7. He was killed by Herod, Acts 12, 1 and 2. James, number 2. With Peter and James, he was in the inner circle of the apostles, John, number 4. And who was called the zealot? Number 3, Simon. Then let's fill in the next 6 questions. How many recorded miracles did Jesus perform? 35. But John said, as he closes out his book, if we had a record, they'd all been recorded, then... Yeah, okay. You think that's literally true?
It's not like he was busy contending.
He was, but that statement's not literal. I mean, the world's a big place, and it would be possible to actually record everything that Jesus did. I mean, even if you did 1,000 things a day for 3.5 years, I mean, you can write that down. But it's a hyperbole, it's an exaggeration to say he did a lot more than we can imagine. How many did Jesus raise from the dead? 3. Out of how many did he cast out devils? 6. And again, those are just the recorded ones that we have. How many miracles did Jesus perform regarding nature? 9. Total number of men Jesus fed on 2 occasions? Put that at 9,000. How many bodily cures by Jesus are recorded? 17. All right. The Lord went to the city of Capernaum after he ended his sayings. There was a man who was a centurion, sent to him saying a servant was at the point of death. The elders sent some of the Jews, the elders of the Jews asked Jesus to heal the servant because the man had built them a synagogue. So there were some good people, Jews and Gentiles in the first century, and this fellow was one of them. Jesus said of him, I have not found so great faith, no, not in Israel. So here you have a non-Hebrew, and Jesus really says something great about him. The Lord healed this man's servant. The next day, the Lord went to Nain and sees the people they're carrying out dead man. This lady's son had died. So the Lord said to the mother, weep not, and said to the young man, arise. Well, that young fellow was also another person who didn't have faith. The man who had been dead sat up and began to speak, and the people glorified God, saying that a great prophet had come to town. Okay, let's take a look as far as some supplemental material. Luke chapter 6, 4, verses 16 through 23. Luke 4, 16 to 23, and then 28 to 31. I'm going to read this, skip a few verses, just for the sake of time. This takes us back to where we were talking about the Lord's been tempted. You find that in the opening verses of Luke chapter 4, and then he now shows up at Nazareth, going back to where his boyhood had taken place. Came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and as he entered, as his custom was, into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up to read. And there was delivered unto him the book of the prophet Isaiah. And he opened and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he anointed me to preach good tidings to the poor. He hath sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovering sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are abused, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord." And he closed the book and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. And the eyes of all in the synagogue were fastened on him. And he began to say unto them, "Today hath this scripture been fulfilled in your ears." And all bearing witness and wondered at the words of grace which proceeded out of his mouth. And they said, "Is not this Joseph's son?" And he said unto them, "Doubtless ye will say unto me this parable, Physician, heal thyself. And whatsoever we have heard done at Capernaum, do also here in thine own country." And then 28 to 31. And they were all filled with wrath in the synagogue as they heard these things. And they rose up and cast him forth out of the city and led him unto the brow of the hill whereon their city was built, that they might throw him down headlong. But he, passing through the midst of them, went his way. And he came down to Capernaum, a city of Galilee, and that's what we read about in the lesson, okay? And he came down to Capernaum, a city of Galilee, and he was teaching them on the Sabbath day. And then the Bible says they were astonished by his teaching. Now, this isn't here, but if you were to look at the parallel accounts, you would find that prior to this time, the Lord's disciples had pretty much been part-time disciples. They're with him some, but they're still out there in the secular world. John 1, verses 35 through 51. But now Jesus moves to Capernaum. And when he moves up to Capernaum, things, as was hinted at in the lesson, things begin to change. In that northern section of Israel, in Capernaum, Jesus' disciples are going to move away from, if you will, a part-time status. They're not going to have a part-time job with Jesus, but now they're going to be, if you will, full-time disciples. And not only are they going to be full-time disciples, but as they switch their status, they're going to be called really to a more rigorous level of service. You may remember that statement from Matthew chapter 4, verse 19, "Come ye after me, and I will make you to become fishers of men." The force of that really is here, exclamation mark, after me. Jesus was essentially saying, you come, you join my party. When you think about a presidential campaign, are there some candidates who will say to a person, "I want you to come and join my team"? I mean, they put together their election team. And, you might be doing some things, on the side for the guy or for the lady before things really get started. But once things get into full swing mode and they say, "You come, you work for me," how fully are you on board if you're going to maintain that job? 100%. You're 100% committed. And, I mean, we're going to do everything that we can to get you elected. We're going to give you basically our lives. 24/7 we're going to be on call. That's what happened with Jesus' disciples once he gets up to Capernaum and begins to make this change. Now, if you're going to have someone make that kind of commitment, don't you need to probably have them motivated a bit? You come, you help me get elected. And what's the incentive going to be? Well, I might make you this, or I might give you this. I'm going to maybe make you a member of my cabinet and so forth. Jesus needed something to help these fellows really cement their commitment. So do you remember? The Lord is teaching. You've got some fishing boats there. Peter's been out with some others. They've fished all night. It hasn't gone very well. He's surely whipped. I mean, they've come in, they've fished, they've washed out their nets. They probably want a net. And the Lord tells Peter what? Let's go out and fish. And Peter says, "We've been out all night. No fish biting today." Lord says, "Let's go out." And they go out. And what happens as far as the fishing event? Oh yeah, they catch some fish. The nets begin to break and the boats begin to sink. That event sealed the deal for the apostles. Jesus says, "I'm going to call you into full-time service. I'm going to call you into this rigorous service. And let me show you who I am. Let me show you why I can make this demand of you." And once Peter sees that from his background, a fishing background, it's nobody fishes like this. So they are on board at that point in time, and the Bible says that they followed him. And that word that's translated followed, it means to follow one another. It implies fellowship, joint participation, a side-by-side walking with another, with one another. So, again, even to the point where we're going to die with you, we're going to literally give our life for your cause. So the Lord knew what he was doing in trying to bring people on board. Now, when you think about Jesus, and as I said as we were going through the lesson, we don't know all of the occupations that the apostles came from. But at least about a third of them came from a fishing background. If you were Jesus, why might you have picked people from a fishing background? I think there were a couple reasons for this.
Part of it, I think, would be because of their lack of great education.
Okay.
They were common people.
All right. If you're going to take some scholars, you probably would have to unteach them something, wouldn't you? I mean, their head is filled with all kinds of preconceived ideas. But you get the guy out there, you know, he's probably got a lot of sense, the guy who's out there in the fishing boat. And, you know, wants to probably do what's right when it comes to spiritual things. But there's a lot of stuff maybe that he hasn't considered. So you've got basically clean material to work with spiritually. So that made sense. Why else might Jesus have selected fishermen? All right, I think that's got to be another thing. Work ethic. You know, they're going to be up early. And they're going to be out there. All of the laborious toil. And Jesus had in mind that his fellows were going to do some traveling. So from the standpoint of a work ethic, that also would have been very, very helpful. Anything else?
The fact that they were fishermen, that was probably a job at that time right around the lake.
Yeah, I think that's the other thing. Had Jesus picked up some scholars, there probably would have been, and there could have been some in the group. And Paul certainly, I think, would qualify for that. But, you know, if somebody's talking to the president or the mayor, they might not be all that comfortable. But can you talk to the fisherman? Anybody can talk to the fisherman. I mean, he's just, well, that's a fisherman, you know, that's Joe. And we can go over there, Mayo come, President May, you know, say hi to him, those kinds of things. So approachability also seems to be the third element there. Betty, have another thought?
Well, another thing would be that even though they might be discouraged one day because they didn't get good results, they still
Yeah. Here were people who understood commitment. And if we get involved with this, we're going, whether the conditions are good or bad, we're going to stick with the program. So, yes. I think that would be another great answer. Now, here's the other thing that I wanted to tie in with you earlier. When you look at the map on the front, I mean, that really doesn't look like much territory. If you look at Israel today, it really doesn't look like much territory. And remember we said Phoenicia, that place is really, you know, north and kind of outside of Palestine a little bit. If you've ever wondered, well, why did Jesus, he had 3.5 years. So why didn't Jesus go into other countries, other places and teach? Let me suggest to you, that there was a good reason for that. Josephus, who wrote A Generation After Jesus, said, and I'm going to give you this information, just about read it word for word. In the area of Galilee, so that is that northern section, in the area of Galilee that had, about the time of Jesus, 204 cities. 204 cities, or thereabouts, in that upper section of Israel. And each of those communities had at least 15,000 people. In each of those communities. Now, if you do the math, that means that in just that upper section of Galilee, you've got more than 3 million people. 3 million people in that topmost section of the map. So, again, continuing with the notes here. If the Lord and the apostles traveled 7 days a week, and they spoke in two communities a day, they would have needed 3 months to have visited just the communities in Galilee. And then when you began to look at Samaria, and he did do some work there, and you began to look at Jerusalem, Judea, that lower section as well, you began to see that, yeah, in 3.5 years, you're going to have to really hustle to go and to communicate your message, even if you've got a dozen helpers. And this also helps us understand, I think, one other point. When you begin to look at Jesus' teachings, do you find that he sometimes used the same material? Preached the same sermon, basically, in some places? He did. And you have to wonder why he did that. I mean, inspiration could have caused him to just, you know, speak, and he never would have had to have reflected on anything. But I think that also finding the same teachings on various occasions, or the essentially the same teachings, uses some of the same illustrations. If you're trying to reach, you know, at least 3 million people in just the upper section, plus the people in the middle and plus the people in the lower section, are you probably, I mean, it's like, let's compare it to a presidential candidate. He's going to go out and give the stump speech. So he's traipsing east, west, north, south. Are you going to hear basically the same information wherever he is in the country? Yeah. I mean, he doesn't have time to come out and write up a new stump speech. I mean, you know, he might make some adjustments and change the theme a little bit as he's on the bus or on the train, plane, whatever it is. But it's, you know, my schedule's killing me. So I've got some basic information that I'm going to communicate, and I'm going to take that basic information and I'm going to share it with as many people as I can. And the focus is going to be on getting the main message out rather than always trying to come up with new material. So Jesus had a very, very demanding schedule. Such was also true for the apostles. And when you begin to see the population in the ancient world, you have to say, wow, these fellows really were committed.